In the news.
Good morning, I'm Professor Shaw.
And I'm Professor McDaniel. Welcome to In the News for American and Texas Politics.
And you have made it. This is our last In the News segment, so we'll do like we always do. We'll bring it hard, we'll bring it fast, and you guys will be undoubtedly very happy with the product. That's our service guarantee to you. Okay. So we've been falling into a little bit of this starting international and kind of narrowing towards more localized things, and we're kind of comfortable with that pattern. So for this week's In the News, we're going to follow that, you know, blueprint, and we're going to start with just one international thing we wanted to cover, although we'll talk a little bit about immigration, which is somewhat international, but I want to just mention the North Korea situation. It'd be kind of crazy not to at least put it on the table and to alert you guys to it, especially since this set of modules will include, or does include, economic, domestic, and foreign policy. So the foreign policy implications here are fairly straightforward, although North Korea may be the most idiosyncratic, the most unique kind of foreign policy situation. We've talked about multilateralism, and we've talked about the Bush doctrine and the Obama doctrine. All of that kind of makes sense, I guess, in a post-Cold War world, in a post-9/11 world even. But it's very difficult to figure out what to do with North Korea. The best I can do, so for those of you who haven't been paying attention, North Korea continues to engage in missile exercises despite, you know, admonitions from the rest of the world, ranging from, you know, places that are hostile to the North Korean regime, like the United States, to places that are kind of less hostile, like maybe China. All of them are agreed that this is a bad thing, that this is destabilizing. The South Koreans and the Japanese are particularly upset because they don't need a very long missile launch to get something to Japan or to South Korea. The United States obviously is significant, has significant assets and is sort of long allied relationships with South Korea and Japan. So, you know, the United States is vested in this. I guess maybe the best, you know, kind of intellectual take I can give to you guys is to link it to the question of negotiating bilaterally versus multilaterally. What the United States has preferred in the past with respect to North Korea is to work multilaterally. That is to use the Japanese, the South Koreans, and the Chinese in particular to want to bring them into any negotiations with North Korea. And the notion is that, you know, there need to be, you know, the particular concerns are with the Japanese and the South Koreans, but that only China really has any kind of sway with the regime in North Korea, which is very insular, that just doesn't really talk or have relations with any other countries. So we need them in on the negotiations, probably even the Russians as well, because the Russians during the Cold War had relations with the North Koreans as well. But the North Koreans have typically balked at that. They prefer or would prefer to have bilateral as opposed to multilateral. They want bilateral talks with the United States, and they don't really want any of these other actors in on it. And it's not clear exactly what they would want from the United States anyway. North Korea is exceptionally isolated. They do seem to have kind of an illicit trade going on with countries like Iran, where they've been purchasing weapons and things like that. But even these things, you know, the Iranians deny this, although, you know, there's no real reason to believe the Iranians haven't been brokering arms deals with the North Koreans. So it's a very tricky place. It's a very tricky place that the United States is in right now. Clearly, everybody wants, except the North Koreans to stop launching these, you know, missile tests, but no one quite knows what to do about it. The Trump administration has, it's been interesting. The Trump campaign was very critical of President Obama, as well as being critical of President Bush about how those administrations were handling relations with North Korea, but it's not clear what the alternative is. And Trump has been basically issuing threats to the North Koreans about, you know, we're going to retaliate like nothing the world has ever seen before. It's unclear whether this is helpful or constructive or part of a larger plan. It's just hard to say right now. So, you know, that's what's going on there. We want to turn now the focus from this sort of one international situation. There are obviously others. We told you last week to keep your eyes on Venezuela. Keep your eyes on Venezuela. There continue to be protests and sort of government reactions and crackdowns to what a lot of people think was an illicit election, an illegitimate election in Venezuela a couple weeks ago. So that's going on. But let's turn to the United States, where Professor McDaniel and I, as we were scoping out this class, thought there were at least three or four different topics we wanted to cover. So we'll try to do them in kind of rapid-fire fashion. But we want to talk a little bit about immigration reform, about the Democrats and tax reform or tax overhaul. Trump seems to be actually reaching out to the Democrats, the opioid crisis, and the Afghan war. So let's talk about these. You're an immigration maven. You know a little bit about immigration. What do you got for us on that?
So last week, President Trump, along with two members of Congress, introduced the RAISE Act. So an act, RAISE stands for Reforming America, American Immigration for a Strong Economy. They were really
looking
for...
Do you think they fit that? I mean, they couldn't possibly have thought that and then just noticed, hey...
Yeah.
That's they, RAISE.
Yeah, yeah. Just like SHIELD or things like that. They really worked hard on this one. So this one is really to change the visa system and restrict how we allow immigrants to come in. So restricting the role of family. So which family members can be allowed to come over, which family members cannot. But also there's an emphasis on certain skills. And so they're putting a strong emphasis on skills that were in the past, but then also English proficiency. And so there are kind of several steps here. And I think the English proficiency is where a lot of people are getting a lot of strong pushback. Because what they're basically saying is, well, are you saying that in order to be an American, you must speak English? And there's kind of this argument of what should be an English-only nation, things like that. So that's been put forward, and really it's an attempt to, in some ways, reduce the amount of immigration and say, if we're going to bring in immigrants, we're only going to bring in those with certain skills, highly needed skills. And I mean, be truthful, this is already out there, that if you before you go and ask for a foreign worker for a position, you must advertise in the U.S. And so you must advertise in the U.S. for this position. If it doesn't get filled, then you can go overseas. And it actually has become comical in some cases. So, this had to be maybe like a decade ago. There was a strip club in Miami that wanted to hire a stripper from, I guess, Brazil or somewhere like that. But before they could hire her, they had to put the ad out in, they were forced to put the ad out in the Miami newspapers. So there's all of this kind of, this argument about this, and it's very, very weird situation. But then also the key thing about visas and who gets visas, who doesn't get visas. And this really boils down to, again, they're trying to say, look, if you're coming in here, you're only coming here to increase the economy, to make the economy stronger. And you're gonna provide certain skills that are desperately needed. But then you also have the English proficiency part, and again, the justification for that, I think they're gonna have to work a little bit harder on that to solidify that.
Hmm. Well, I wanna kind of take these different sets of issues. Immigration reform constitutes maybe the first, it's kind of hard to tell with the sequencing, but the first effort by the Trump administration and the Republican Congress to move on to expand the agenda after the botched attempt to repeal and replace Obamacare, right? So they took a shot at health care. That was kind of their first big thing, and it didn't work. So now immigration reform, the tax overhaul, the opioid crisis, legislation relevant to the opioid crisis, and how to deal with the Afghan war, these four issues are now on the agenda, and they represent an attempt by the administration, by the Republican Congress, to move the debate beyond, you know, Obamacare, right? So Professor McDaniel pointed out immigration reform, there are lots of different coalitional possibilities here. This was a major piece of Trump's campaign. You know, perhaps the biggest substantive issue that he campaigned upon was, you know, the immigration issue, right? Illegal immigration, what are we going to do about it? Immigration reform, I would encourage you guys to think about immigration as an issue in the United States is comprised of two different elements. It's probably more, but at least two different. The first is border security, and the other is immigration reform. So border security, Republicans actually have kind of a good hand with respect to public opinion. People are in favor of tightening the border, of securing the border, of taking measures to enforce the laws that exist. On immigration reform, the Democrats have a better hand, a better position. That is, most people think there ought to be some kind of pathway to citizenship, that you have 11 million people in the United States illegally, and you know they're living in the shadows, and some sort of serious attempt to deal with this issue needs to occur. So Trump is trying to deal with these things, and he might be able to get a deal cut, you know, if he combines border security measures with some immigration reform. In other words, if the Democrats give him something on border security, maybe he can give them something on immigration reform, right? Is that actually going to happen? I don't know, but it's a point of opportunity, and Trump's trying to, you know, kind of reboot the Etch-a-Sketch here. On overhaul, on taxes, once again, he's reaching out to Democrats because there are some conservatives, Republicans, that he doesn't think he can get on a tax reform plan. He thinks he's going to need, what Trump would basically like to do is lower the business tax, the corporate business tax in the United States, which actually is high in relative terms. It's much higher than it is in places like Ireland or other European countries, which is ironic, right? We always think of Europe as being high tax, but the corporate tax rates in the United States are relatively pretty high. Trump would like to see those lowered. He'd like to see the Social Security tax transformed slightly. He would, I don't know that income tax rates are going to be on the docket, but he wants to streamline and limit the tax code in the United States in a way that makes it easier for business to do business, right? And he thinks he might be able to work with some Democrats on that, you know, in a way that they didn't do on healthcare, you know. So you got immigration reform, Democrats on the reaching out to Democrats on the tax overhaul. Then you've got this, as you all are probably aware, this opium or opioid crisis that exists in the United States that was really, it's really been kind of pronounced in states like Vermont and New Hampshire. I would simply point out, I don't have expertise on this at all, but I would point out from a political point of view, the sorts of people who are affected by this, these sort of lower socioeconomic status, predominantly white communities, these communities have been devastated by this opioid crisis, and they were critical to electing Trump. So Trump is sensitive. I think he's probably sensitive from a humanitarian point of view, but he's certainly sensitive from a political point of view about the relevance of these constituents. And so he is working to craft corrective legislation to try to deal with the opioid crisis. Then the fourth thing we had on the docket here is the Afghan war. I just came across this article. I don't know if Professor McDaniel saw it, but I sort of threw it in here with the other issues, that Trump is exploring options for what, you know, we'll use the air quotes here, privatizing the Afghan war. And I think this is, he's at least looking at, and so when I hear privatizing, I always think of, like, you know, what is it, Blackbriar from the Bourne movies?
Yeah,
right?
Yeah.
You know, or some of these sort of mercenary, you know, corporations that exist out there that have, you know, merchants of war who go out and fight these wars instead of the government actually doing it. I don't, maybe I've just seen too many movies, but I always have that sort of image in my head. But Trump apparently is exploring this option because, you know, again, he made these pledges during the campaign to, you know, reduce the military's presence. But now that he's president and the military are coming back and saying, hey, man, if you leave, if you just pull all the troops out of Afghanistan, that place is just going to go to hell in a handbasket. And, you know, these terrorist groups are going to move in. The Russians are going to move in. You know, you can't do that. So how do you get out of this quandary? How do you draw down troop levels without allowing the Afghan government to collapse? Maybe he can hire some people to go in and do the things, the security things that he thinks he needs to do. So now I mentioned that in this sort of group of issues where I think he's trying to sort of restart his agenda. I think he's looking at forming different sorts of coalitions, not just, you know, relying on a right of center, especially a very conservative set of Republicans. He's trying to figure out, can I get Democrats on any of these issues? Can I take care of the constituents that are really critical to my election and actually, you know, get something done? Because that's been a real problem with the first 6 months. So, all right, we just wanted to put that on the docket. We also have a second, so if that's our basket, sort of Trump and domestic issues, we got another basket. It's a whole bunch of issues this week came up involving issues of race, diversity, affirmative action. And so I want to talk about Google, but I think Professor McDaniel has a couple things on the NAACP and the Missouri Travel Advisory, yes. Right? And DOJ and some affirmative action stuff. So why don't we start with the race stuff and then we can go to the gender stuff.
Okay. It was announced last week that the DOJ will be investigating or suing certain universities that they believe their affirmative action policies actually harm whites in particular. And so this has been a major concern that the way that affirmative action is set up, specifically the racial aspect of affirmative action. I think what's important to understand is that affirmative action is multi-dimensional. It's not just about race. There's a race component, a gender component, whether that's your handicap, veteran status. When we talk about affirmative action, there are multiple things that go into this, but race seems to really be the one that people really glom onto and get the most upset about. And so there are, again, a number of cases. University of Texas with the Fisher case has been central in this. And so you're seeing this going out where you are seeing, are the affirmative action laws set up in such a way they're actually discriminatory against whites? Are they hurting whites? And at the same time, you're seeing Harvard is being sued because they believe its admissions policy actually is harmful to Asian Americans. So there's an opinion piece in the Washington Post today by the person who brought the suit saying, you know, Harvard has a horrible history. So, for instance, it tried to reduce the number of Jews that went to Harvard. And so what they're trying to do right now is cap the number of Asian Americans because they're trying to present a certain type of image. And what's important to note is that this issue of affirmative action in Asian Americans has really been a big issue. So as Professor Shaw can probably point out, from being in California, there has been a great deal of concern about to what degree are these policies actually hurting Asian Americans. Now, again, what's important to note when we talk about Asian Americans doing well, it's a certain segment. So if you think about the economic prowess of Asian Americans, what you find is that it's kind of bimodal in the sense that one group is doing really well, another group is not doing so well. And the groups that are doing well are the groups that immigrated because of certain skill levels. And so you bring in people with high skills, they're already taking high jobs, whereas individuals who are coming over because of fleeing political repression and things of that nature, they are not doing as well economically. So it's not like the whole Asian American community is flourishing. Certain aspects of it are. And if you probably look at these cases, you'll find that certain people from certain ethnic backgrounds are the ones who have been advancing the most. So this is kind of a big case. I'm going to see how this goes about. Second, we have the NAACP issued actually its first ever travel advisory to a state, and it issued it to the state of Missouri. And the reason for this is that Missouri, the legislature passed a law, passed a bill, the governor signed it, putting into law, which makes it more difficult for individuals to sue regarding employment and housing discrimination. And so what Missouri has basically said is, you know what you've done here is, you know, you made it more difficult or made it, I guess, more difficult for people to fight discrimination and made it easier for people to discriminate. And this kind of hit close to home because I grew up in St. Louis and, surprise, surprise, victim of housing discrimination. So my mom was looking at an apartment. She walked around, she looked. And she's like, okay, I'll probably take this place. And she called, like, oh, we're all booked up. She's like, that's interesting. So her boss, who was white, called and said, hey, I'm interested in looking for an apartment, And the woman said, oh, yeah, we got plenty of places. He's like, oh, that's funny, because you just told the woman I work with that there are none. Well, you see what happened was. And, you know, now again, I'm four when this is going on, so I'm not really paying attention. We're right across the street from Grant's Farm. So Grant's Farm is basically this huge kind of, how do I describe it? It's like a playground that Anheuser-Busch built. So, I mean, they're not handing out beer to kids, but it's like you can do all kinds of stuff. But the great thing about it is you can see the Clydesdales. So I can see the Clydesdales from my window. So I was like, oh, the Clydesdales, you know. So I didn't notice this. And my mom kind of talked about the fact that, yeah, we were the only black family there. And because I had a 3 or 4 year old with me, people were actually willing to talk. But it was a bit dicey. So they issued this travel advisory basically saying, look, this is not a state that you want to be in. And again, as we've been talking about over and over again, what you have here is pitting the business interest against, I guess, really what you might consider to be the social conservatives, things of that nature. And if we talk about the Montgomery bus boycott, we talk about all these boycotts, really it's trying to split this coalition of business interest and social conservatives. You see the same thing going on in Texas. So, for instance, again, a number of business interests have actually come out and spoken out against Governor Abbott. There was a letter sent to Governor Abbott earlier this week by a number of business interests and number of big business names in Houston who were saying, look, this transgender bathroom bill is horrible for business. And so what you've got is Governor Abbott trying to work with the business interests but also appease the social conservatives, and you're seeing a splintering of this coalition. So this is really one of the things to kind of pay attention to, because, again, think about the Ferguson case, if you think about the University of Missouri. Again, and the state of Missouri does not have the greatest history in regards to race. It was state for Dred Scott. Missouri was a slave state. However, it didn't formally secede from the Union because it was split. And then I'm going to ask one, I don't know if it's a funny story, but one interesting story is there was a fight over whether or not Kansas would be a free state or a slave state. And what Congress said is, you know what, we'll let the people of Kansas decide. And so what happened is a bunch of pro-slavery people from Missouri just moved into Kansas and tried to take over the polls. And so we think of John Brown. If you ever look up the history of John Brown and his raid on Harper's Ferry in Virginia, John Brown kind of got his start in fighting against slavery there. So again, Missouri has this very mixed history when it comes to race. If you think of the work of Mark Twain, these are other examples. Again, I went to grade school there, so I know all these things. Sorry, didn't mean to be a Missouri history lesson.
That's good. I like Missouri. It's a really interesting state.
Oh, yeah.
They got good caves.
Yeah.
Surprisingly good caves.
They actually have diamonds there, too.
It's, you know, it actually, we were traveling one time, we were driving from Santa Monica out to Detroit, and, you know, went through East St. Louis, and it was a little bit like, you ever seen the movie Vacation?
East St. Louis is Illinois.
Yeah. East St. Louis, I felt like Chevy Chase in Vacation. I stopped there at a KFC, and I don't know if this is probably right for me right now, but I got my KFC and went, got on the road. But it was surprisingly hilly. Yeah. It's actually quite beautiful. But I like the history. Missouri is a really interesting state. In a lot of ways, you know, I do a lot of election politics, and Missouri, it's changed a little bit. It used to be like one of the ultimate bellwether states, mm-hmm. because it has an appreciable African-American population. It has a Catholic population. It has a rural population. It has two metropolitan areas, significant metropolitan areas in St. Louis and Kansas City.
I don't consider Kansas City metropolitan.
Yeah, I know.
It's the wrong side of the state.
I went there going about 85 miles an hour on the highway and thought it looked really cool last year. So
the funny thing about Kansas City is when you land at the airport, it's in Kansas, so you drive for 40 minutes before you actually like see Kansas City.
I know. I couldn't understand. When I was a kid, I didn't understand why Kansas City was in Missouri. But, you know, be that as it may. But the main point that we wanted to raise here, I mean, these singular episodes, and this is what we want to do generally with the In the News segment, is connect them back up to themes we've been talking about. And so in the case of the Department of Justice lawsuit, the DOJ, we talked about how, you know, Department of Justice and the American government is constantly trying to navigate this question of pursuing broader societal goals, diversity, lack of discrimination, et cetera, against this notion of individual rights. And with a conservative administration and a more conservative Department of Justice, the pendulum swings from really going out of its way to, you know, aggressively pursue civil rights cases to considering these reverse discrimination cases, right? And those are the political consequences of, you know, Donald Trump versus Barack Obama or Hillary Clinton. In the travel advisory case, again, you know, Professor McDaniel's point about the continued, you know, first of all, we talked a lot in the civil rights lectures about strategies, about how you deal with, you know, an attempt to move your group's interests forward, to claim the protections and guarantees of the Constitution that you think you are entitled to as citizens of the United States, how best to do that. And the NAACP is still a big actor, and they still, interestingly, are still kind of using in a modern way this strategy developed by King and others, which is to basically play to these fissures, to these cleavages within the white community. And in Missouri, that's what they're trying to do, which is to link policy in a way that allows them to bring economic pressure and to kind of hive off elements of the conservative coalition and, you know, get the policies that they want. That was also been the case in Texas. One last thing kind of in this, you know, general discussion of diversity and race and discrimination and how you, you know, deal with these things is an episode that I think a lot of you probably heard from Google this last week. There was an engineer at Google, James Damore, D-A-M-O-R-E, I believe it's pronounced Damore, sent out a memo. And it was an internal memo at Google directed at the issue of why there aren't more female engineers and personnel at Google. Google has this enormous issue. In fact, there's a lawsuit against Google right now because I believe, and I'm sort of making this up, but I think it's close to reality, that something like only 20% of Google employees are female. Maybe lower than that. But so there's this massive discrepancy in the distribution of men versus women at Google. The lawsuit is actually about women not getting equal pay at Google. And so Google's had all these policies aimed to deal with these issues. And DeMoore, this engineer, wrote this memo about, you know, 12, 10 pages or so, asking, you know, why are we doing this? These diversity programs, he argues, are hurting Google. They're not helping. They're not addressing the problems. And he raises this sort of possibility that, you know, maybe the problems here aren't discrimination. Maybe the problems are that women just aren't as interested in and aren't as good at some of these things that we value at Google as men. Right? So this, as you might imagine, has produced a firestorm. DeMoore was, now this was leaked. Now it wasn't an internal memo that got mysteriously leaked. He put it out there and it was quickly disseminated. It was a Google Docs, ironically, Google Docs document that got leaked to the press. And there's been a whole bunch of reaction from the right and the left. There's an article on Salon.com this morning talking about how DeMoore plays into all these false stereotypes about biologically based differences in, you know, sort of computational and scientific abilities of men versus women. There are a lot of articles on the right saying this is another example of political correctness, that DeMoore actually just sort of raises this as a possibility. He doesn't say it's the fact. He just says maybe there are differences that aren't simply socially constructed. And he's fired for that. How is it, you know, how can you be fired for that? He did not discriminate against it, et cetera, et cetera. So Google's CEO cut short his vacation. You know that's serious when he cut short his vacation to have a virtual town hall last Thursday. So, but again, you know, this particular episode I think is interesting in its own, but also speaks to this larger issue of, you know, what can you say? What can you be fired for? This question of, you know, particularly with gender, these questions of biological difference versus socially constructed differences and what is legitimate and what is not, it's kind of a fascinating argument against the backdrop of one of the world's largest and kind of most important companies. So we got that's kind of it substantively. So we hit North Korea, you know, kind of politics in the U.S., and then these sort of race and gender issues. But there are a couple other things we want to say in closing. We got two stories, one about SMU, and trigger warnings, and the other is kind of a throwaway article, but we loved it anyway, about San Francisco, because we always like taking shots at San Francisco. So what's the SMU thing?
So the SMU, so again, Southern Methodist University in Dallas. So for many years now,
SMU.
The Mustangs, the school that paid Eric Dickerson so well.
Pony XS.
That's right. So the thing about SMU is that they have the Dallas Hall lawn, and this is kind of a main lawn. And for years, they've been putting up, for 9/11, they've been putting up flags, basically with each flag representing one American who passed away in the terrorist attacks. SMU passed some type of regulation saying, you know, that cannot be used for these types of displays, that the Dallas Hall lawn cannot be used for these types of displays. They need to be moved somewhere else, somewhere that was kind of not in the center. And the argument they gave is that by seeing these flags, it would kind of trigger certain things amongst students. The students were upset. Governor Abbott spoke out against this, and they did change that rule. But it does speak to this larger thing about trigger warnings, what can be said, what can't be said in classes. And I'm not fully sure what the trigger warning thing is. Now, I understand there are certain things which are extremely graphic in nature that you might say, hey, look, it's going to be graphic in nature. So, for instance, when I taught my class on black politics, or I've talked about race, you know, and I'll show pictures of lynchings, I'm like, no, this is, you know, extremely violent stuff. So I'll let you know about that ahead of time. But there have been other cases where people are talking about trigger warnings. We're talking about things that seem somewhat innocuous. Like, I don't understand why this is an issue. Furthermore, you know, this is basically like celebrating Pearl Harbor. This is almost like saying, get rid of the Alamo because it's a trigger warning. I mean, there's some certain things where, like, you might be going too far. Now, if you put up, you know, the images or gruesome images, that's one thing. But putting up flags might be it's kind of seen as an overreach. And so one of the things that it's going on now is you're trying to find this middle ground. So sometimes you're going to go too far, sometimes it's not going to go far enough, and you're trying to really see, okay, what is the proper way to handle this? And what you find is that a lot of times there isn't one perfect way to handle it. A lot of times it's dependent upon the context in which you're in. And, you know, when people get upset about this, saying this is political correctness gone crazy, it's like, well, it may not actually be political correctness, but it's this idea of trying to be aware of other people's feelings and other people's concerns. However, sometimes in doing that, you make decisions that are actually harmful, extremely harmful to the larger group, or you may be overreacting in that regard.
So, in fact, the University of Texas for years, I don't know if they'll do it this year, but has a 9/11 memorial on the mall in between the six-pack, right? And it's actually very moving, and I find it very compelling. It never occurred to me that it would be offensive to anybody, you know, but I'll keep my personal opinions to myself on this. We're closing with a San Francisco Homeowner Association and private roads. I was intrigued by this. Professor McDaniel, you know, the day before we taped the In the News segment, we kind of throw around ideas, and Professor McDaniel highlighted this, and I wasn't aware of it, so I went and looked it up and found the article where just reading from the NPR, had this article yesterday. A four-floor San Francisco mansion at 26 Presidio Terrace was recently on the market for $14.5 million. So for those of you who want to invest in a little real estate, go to San Francisco. It's very affordable. 30 Presidio Terrace, a neighbor in the gated community, last sold for $9.5 million. But Presidio Terrace itself, as in the street, the strip of pavement these Tony residents rely on to reach their front doors, the private road the Homeowners Association has owned for more than a century, that's a bargain. After the Homeowners Association failed to pay a $14 tax bill for three decades, the road went up for auction. All right, a San Jose couple snagged it for about $90,000. Yeah, so Tina Lamb and Michael Chang made their strategic purchase in 2015. But now the newspaper writes they're looking to cash in, maybe by charging the residents of those mansions to park on their private street. I love this story.
It is. And the key thing about this is a very wealthy neighborhood in San Francisco. So this is the neighborhood for Senator Dianne Feinstein, as well as Majority Leader, Nancy Pelosi. My God, I'm forgetting her
minority
name.
Leader.
Minority Leader.
Maybe Majority Leader. We'll see what happens.
Yeah, Minority Leader. It's still going to be Minority Leader. I don't see that happening. So... this is really one of those big things of, you know, people are saying, oh, well, they were sending it to the wrong address. They were sending it to the wrong address for somebody who didn't work here for 30 years. So now the couple that bought it said, look, you know, they actually held on to it for a couple of years. They said, hey, just so you know, we own this now, so would you like to buy it back? Would you like to rent it? What would you like to do? Let's work this out. Let's make a deal. And be truthful, this is an example, and they're trying to fight it in court, and it's probably a long, drawn-out battle, but it's really an issue of bad bookkeeping. And bad bookkeeping leading to this, and it does involve the government because they were supposed to pay taxes, and the government's like, oh, you didn't pay your taxes? We're taking it from you. All right, so taking it from you, we'll put it up for auction, and guess what? Somebody got it. So... if you think about, you know, I remember going to these government auctions, like they would seize vehicles from drug dealers. Yeah. And so, you know.
That was a big thing in the 80s, yeah. Like, you know, boats and stuff like that seized in drug deals, yeah.
Yeah, and so, I mean, it wasn't a drug deal, but you didn't pay your taxes.
Yeah.
So.
I was always looking for like a $20 cigarette boat or something like that.
Yeah.
But it never happened to me.
I understand. but this is kind of, I mean, it's a funny story, but it's also a story of like, you know, of you have these people, these million-dollar homes, and you keep wondering, why is their tax bill so low for this private road? And the thing about San Francisco has a bunch of private roads where they basically, you know, they take care of it. You know, the city isn't involved, things like that. They didn't pay the tax bill, and so now somebody else owns it, and now they have to negotiate this. And it could turn into a long, drawn-out court battle. But the court battle, I think, will primarily be between the state, I think the city and the Homeowners Association, not between the owners and that. So the owners just kind of sit there and wait. They just had to pay their taxes on the property, and they're good. And I don't think the tax bill is that high. So I don't think it's gone up more than, you know, maybe 20, maybe like 20 bucks a year. So
yeah, a couple things are relevant here. We'll get you out of here for the day, for the semester, I guess. The first is that this is a story that we just liked because it was sort of funny. But the more you think about it, the more it plays into some of the ideas and themes of government that we've been talking about throughout the semester, right? California has a lot of public land, and they also have a lot of private land, and that way they're like Texas. I grew up in San Diego, and San Diego had this massive area down by the waterfront off the harbor that was owned by the Marine Corps and the Navy. The Marines moved out, moved to another place in San Diego. The Navy finally sold this. So this was unbelievably prime property for a long period of time, and it reverted to the city of San Diego, and the city of San Diego didn't know what to do with it for a while. They were talking about building low-income housing on it. Now, I'm as much in favor of low-income housing as the next guy, but this has got to be some of the most unbelievably affluent property in the country. It's right on the harbor in San Diego, so that idea was never probably going to be a starter. San Francisco has a lot of similar territory. The Presidio area that we're talking about refers to, the reason it's called the Presidio is it used to be military-owned land, and it still is a chunk of it that's owned by the military. But
there's
military
called the Presidio.
Yeah, with I think Kevin Costner.
Yeah, Kevin Costner. Yeah.
Okay, but at any rate, as the U.S. military presence sort of shrinks in the United States, those territories become available. A lot of them are in these prime areas and metropolitan areas. You know, to bring it home, make it a little more local. Austin Bergstrom International Airport is on what used to be Bergstrom Air Force Base, which is why they had, you know, these, you know, unbelievably long and, you know, kind of appropriate runways and spaces for landing planes. And so when I first moved here, we were over in Mueller was our airport. Austin Bergstrom became this. So there's a lot of this kind of territory around, and cities have interesting decisions about what to do with this land when it becomes available. Right, and you know, a lot of it's in this sort of prime area. Texas is uniquely advantaged compared to California because all the expensive space in California is right on the coast, whereas Texas has, we got room if nothing else. Yeah. And you know, it plays into again these sorts of local versus state versus federal arguments, you know, versus the rights of private citizens we've been talking about all semester. Right, so with that, I got some office hours today. I think Professor McDaniel's around for the rest of the week. You know, give us a holler if you have any problems or issues. We've really enjoyed your company. I've seen a few of you. I'd like to see a few more of you before the semester is over. But with that, I think we're done.
All right. Have a good day.
All right. See you later.
The Government 310 in the News podcast is hosted by Drs. Darren Shaw and Eric McDaniel, and is produced by the Liberal Arts ITS Development Studio and the Department of Government and the College of Liberal Arts at the University of Texas at Austin.